And that's the music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Today on the show, it is our last show of 2011. So we're going to spend some time today talking about some of our favorite moments from 2011. The things that we loved, the things that moved us, the things that defined the year for us. You probably know what some of them are, but we're hoping some of them will be new to you. And, of course, as always, we will talk about what is making us happy this week. So before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, tell everybody what you do.
Well, I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do?
I edit movies coverage for NPR.org, and I hack up bits of sticky things all over my desk.
Do you?
This week, anyway.
Sick, are you?
Yeah.
Glenn Weldon, what do you do?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, it's awfully good to see everybody again. It is that time of year, as everyone undoubtedly knows, when people begin, as we're going to do today, to list the things from the year. I have conflicted feelings about this, Glenn. How do you feel?
Well, I just wanted to kick off this discussion by situating us correctly. I speak now as a reader of many of these best of year top five, top ten lists.
Sure.
Not as a writer, and so that falls to me to be the voice, as always, of the people, as is my wont.
The angry people.
We readers, I just want to say to the critical community out there that we readers come to these lists and we know that the first paragraph or so we can dismiss. I mentioned this somewhat last year. Yeah. It seems to me that something has happened and that introductory paragraph, which is filled with whining about how difficult it is to make these lists and why do we have to make these lists after all and they're so arbitrary and there's no room for nuance and analysis and what you get from that.
And then those same people have like peacock plumes when they see their traffic.
That's true. Mm. What we detect, because we're not dumb, what we detect from those paragraphs are your resentment of having to do this all.
Mm-hmm,
it seems to me that this year I've been reading more of these lists where that resentment has become the subject of the article.
Yeah.
It really has seemed to metastasize. And so I want to say, again, voice of the people, mm-hmm. I say unto the critical community, suck it up.
Yeah.
Think about how you sound to us when you start whining about this, because what you sound like are people who are whining about the fact that you think and write, hopefully in that order, about things that you love for a living.
Yeah.
And there are people who make these lists on their personal blogs, on their Tumblrs.
It's like shoveling coal over here.
Yeah. Exactly.
It beats working in the mines, this business.
So here's what I want to say. No caveats. No caviling. We're going to pick these things that were the best of the year, and we're going to come out and say, these were the best of the year. And the commenters will come. Oh, yes, they will come. And they will descend on you like dyspeptic locusts. And I want you to realize that this year, critical community, you have something that you've never had before. This year, you have Linda Holmes' fantastic article about different kinds of internet commenters who come and talk about this. And this provides a kind of psychic shield.
Yes.
This is emotional Kevlar for you to just own it. That's all I'm saying. Let's own it.
Thank you, Glenn. I agree.
I'd like to revise everything I was going to talk about.
Let's own it.
Clear eyes, full heart.
Oh, good God.
Can't possibly lose under these circumstances. So let's choose a moment from 2011 that defined the year culturally for you. Stephen, it can't be the Packers winning the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Oh! All right. Well, let's see. Choice number two.
Scratch.
Hold on. Okay. All right. So no, it can't be the Packers winning the Super Bowl. All right.
And it can't be the Packers winning any other games either.
It's 2-6.
I'm going to have to do this 13 times.
Yeah, well.
But
not last week.
No. I like the fact that everybody who's taunting me about the fact that the Packers lost is not Mike Katziff, whose team actually beat the Packers.
Yeah, anyway.
All right,
go on.
Moment for me that defined the year happened just one of many. Was that a caveat? Did I just do a caveat? I said one of many.
Yes, you did, Stephen Thompson.
Oh, I apologize. All right. It's going to seem self-serving. I think it's legit. A Tiny Desk concert
that's a caveat, by the
performed.
Way.
That's true. Tiny Desk concert performed back in January by Adele.
Oh, God, yeah.
It was before her album 21 came out. Though it is not necessarily my favorite album of the year, is, I think, sort of unmistakably the album of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of strutted into the NPR offices.
She sure did.
Completely in character.
With gigantic eyelashes and
tall hair.
Still wearing, forgot to take my gloves off.
Right.
just immediately took her place behind Bob Boylan's desk. And the first song she sang was Someone Like You, which I thought Ann Powers put it really, really well about that song, where she said that it is the rarest of things that is a new standard.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, true.
And how rarely we get a new standard in a given year. And so very much like right at the beginning of the year, she sings that song. I think sang it better than it is on the record.
I agree.
I thought that, and obviously this is self-serving, but to me, that Tiny Desk concert performance was the definitive version of Someone Like You.
I actually agree with you.
Old friend, why are you so shy? It ain't like you to hold back or hide from the light. I hate to turn up out of the blue uninvited, but I couldn't stay away, I couldn't fight it. I'd hoped you'd see my face and that you'd be reminded that for me it isn't over. Never mind, I'll find someone like you. I wish nothing but the best for.
It very much announced that it was going to be the year of Adele.
Yeah.
And it was, and you know, to be perfectly selfish about it, it was also enormous for our little Tiny Desk concert series to have kind of the artist of the year get up and sing that song. And I think the Adele record itself, in addition to having that standard on it, was an increasingly rare thing, which was a sort of culturally unifying record that cut across a massive array of generations and demographics and appealed to a very broad assortment of people. And that is harder and harder to find in this sort of era of, you know, kind of cultural shrapnelization that is particularly the case in music.
Yeah.
And the fact that this record sold millions and millions and millions of copies and freaked out millions and millions of people is very exciting. It's a very good record. And for me, that moment when she stood up and belted out that song was a big, big cultural moment in 2011.
Not the laugh at the end.
The cackle.
She had left her gloves on the entire performance, and she just, and everybody's still clapping, and she just goes, forgot to take my gloves off.
Because she had sung Rolling in the Deep, mm-hmm. which has a part where they clap. You can see they have a little part where the music cuts out and they clap. And so obviously she expects to generate a clapping sound, and she has her gloves on.
And she's getting church Thup. Clapping.
And she does Thup. Have this horribly, wonderfully goofy sounding cackle that I trust all women who cackle. I say that all the time.
I'm still just astonished by the power of her voice in that small room mm-hmm. with a small band. She sounds fantastic on record. She sounds fantastic at the live events she does, you know, the award shows and all of that. But you know, I had somebody ask me the other day, is her voice big or is her voice not big? And I'm like, you have no idea how big her voice is.
I have to agree with Stephen. I think it's the number one way to hear that song. All right. Trey Graham, tell me about a cultural moment that defined 2011 for you.
All right. I'm not going to go for one tiny moment. I'm going to argue a particular cultural moment may have arrived.
Ooh.
Resolved. 2011 was the year of the queer. Sorry, in good ways and in bad. It seems to me like the culture and the country are finally grappling in a serious way with issues that have been percolating around and about LGBT people for mm-hmm. decades. Leaving politics and public affairs aside, things are happening there, obviously, but there are all these different and increasingly nuanced portrayals of same-sex relationships or genderqueer relationships in pop culture, from The Kids Are All Right, which I'm sneaking in here because it picked up 4 Oscar nominations in calendar 2011.
It did, yes.
To Weekend, which is a very nice little indie film and one of the most painfully honest depictions I've seen of two people kind of falling in love, connecting in a really profound way and not knowing how to express it well and maybe missing an opportunity. It's just a beautiful film. Please go see it.
And it's on Netflix now.
Is it?
It has come to Netflix streaming.
That's fantastic. It is such a terrific movie. On the lighter side, you've got things like RuPaul's Drag Race, which you might dismiss as a kind of minstrelsy if it weren't such a good show. And you've got things like The A-List, which actually is minstrelsy. You're getting storylines on major network shows about everything from bullied teenagers to people whose gender presentation makes people assume they're queer when they're actually not. Yeah, you got Chaz Bono on Dancing with the Stars. What all of this adds up to is anybody's guess, and whether it's going to make a difference in the world is anybody's guess. But as someone who's been out for 20-odd years now, I kind of feel like I've never been quite as central to the national conversation. So for better or for worse, I say Year of the Queer.
Absolutely outstanding. Good choice, Trey Graham. Love that as a moment.
I think you see more gay issues cropping up in commercials. Yeah. I think you saw commercials that included the It Gets Better campaign. Obviously, you know, very mainstream voices like Glee, the fact that you have Jane Lynch hosting awards shows in which she's just openly like, and you know, Neil Patrick Harris as well. It feels much more matter of fact and less...
Yeah,
I think it has in the past.
I think you can track this through the evolution that happened quite quickly this year of the gay best friend character, both in a show, a very funny show called Happy Endings, where a guy, an actor by the name of Adam Pally, is playing a guy who is not stereotypically gay in the way that you would have thought about that 10, even 5 years ago, and in a perhaps less successful attempt by Woody Harrelson in the film Friends with Benefits.
That's true.
Which is more a weird performance than it is.
It is weird, but it's different.
It's different, sure. Now, would it be great if both of those roles were played by actual gay dudes? Yeah. But, you know, it is different. It is. Uh-huh. It's engaging something that it never engaged before, and I think that's a good thing.
I think that's fair to say. Year of the Queer. Thank you, Trey Graham. Glenn Weldon, tell me about a cultural moment that defined 2011 for you.
You know, if Edith Wharton were alive today...
Oh, boy.
A, she wouldn't smell too good, that's for sure. And B, she might consider this year as the beginning of what she might call the age of indolence. This was the first year that I recall just sitting like a pasha on my sofa while popular culture came to me, and I did not go out to meet it. I sat there and clapped my hands twice, and I said, bring me your finest cheeses and salted nut meats. And in they came, through Amazon, through Netflix, through Apple TV. The movies and television came that way. The books came through the Kindle app on my iPad. Comics, by the ton, came through the Comixology app on my iPad. So as I sat there and basically destroyed the social fabric by sitting at my house and not going out and engaging and trading money for goods and services with, people. So part of it, I love this. I love the fact that we've reached this stage of society. I also have to own the fact that I am the reason that society will collapse, that I am the reason that we are headed toward becoming those floating bags of gristle that you saw at in the film WALL-E.
Yes, yes, indeed.
That's where we're headed, because I would rather stay in of a Sunday and sit there. So the moment that I want to talk about here is the moment that future historians will name as the moment society started to collapse, and that moment will be a hologram of me sitting on my sofa ordering an episode of Party Down.
And pizza.
Yes. So what I'm saying here is this is how the world ends, not with a bang, but with a boop, boop.
So it's like a great year for misanthropy.
No, it's a great year for the fact that it's sitting on your couch and eating ho-hos.
The fact that it's the year of indolence and the year of the queer. Glenn, you are making out like a bandit.
Everything's coming up, Glenn.
It's like
House.
The year of the bald man.
Oh, well. I think that's a good choice, and I would agree. I do get a lot more of my culture without leaving the house than I used to, and that's accelerated. I mean, I don't have an iPad, but I have a Kindle Fire, which, contrary to certain reports, I love, and I get lots of stuff on it.
But don't you wish you were paying four times as much?
Yeah, I really, really don't. I get my books on it. I've gone back to reading magazines, which I essentially had completely stopped reading. Oh. I read the New York Times every day.
Can I ask a related question to a podcast we did a few months ago where we all tried comics that we could download?
Have any of you followed up at all?
No.
No.
When I got the Comixology app, I haven't bought them yet. I am pursuing it.
You're pursuing it.
with my
pursuing
brain.
Thoughts of entertaining the idea.
Okay.
I actually did buy Wonder Woman or two, but I haven't read them.
See? Right there. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So 2011, for me, this is not going to come as any giant surprise. Bridesmaids, to me, was the most important thing for me, speaking as a woman who occasionally attempts to be funny. You know, Bridesmaids, it's very easy now to say, well, of course, you know, that's just a big fat pitch down the middle, and it was, you know, it's a sort of crowd-pleasing, whatever. But if you go back in time and read about what people thought was going to happen with that movie, there was a tremendous amount of hand-wringing. Nobody will go. Nobody's going to... It's just a...
Women?
It's just a lady hangover. There was a lot of sort of nobody's going to care. I don't think it'll be successful.
Right.
Lots and lots of worrying about it. And, you know, you could pick a lot of moments in that movie. You could pick the hilarious Melissa McCarthy stuff, which we've talked about before. You could pick the sort of light romance, which I also think is incredibly charming and kind of an underrated part of that movie. Mm-hmm. You could pick the big gross-out stuff. But I am going to pick the very early scene where Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph sit in a sort of coffee shop and talk about the date that Kristen Wiig had the night before. Because it is this combination of sort of bawdy and crude and sensitive and sort of, you shouldn't do this because you always hate yourself. But they can also make dirty jokes. And it is the most well-rounded scene about female friendship that I have seen in a movie in a really, really long time. Because usually you'll have women who are either party girl friends or they're sort of the hand-wringing friends who are always kind of worrying about each other and jealous and things like that. Contained in that scene, that was one of the first scenes I've ever watched in a movie where I thought, this actually sounds like me and my female friends talking. We talk like this. If you want to know how we talk like this. When you talk, Trey, about Weekend and the conversations in Weekend and that they feel both universal and specific, that's how I feel about that conversation in Bridesmaids, that it feels like a conversation that everybody can relate to. Sort of this thrill goes through you. Like, you feel like you recognize yourself and your friends. And yes, we talk exactly like that. It's a combination of you will talk about dirty, crude things from the guy that you were with, but you will also talk about, like, stop that because it's so bad for you. And it is really, really recognizable to me. So as much as I love the really funny stuff, the really high energy stuff, as charming as I think that love story is, and as much as I want to marry that guy 500 times, I'm going to go with the friendship scene, which meant a great deal to me as a lady viewer.
Great choice.
There we go.
So, 2011 to me, year of Bridesmaids. Could not appreciate it more from the women who wrote it, from Paul Feig who directed it, from, you know, the people who went to see it and reviewed it well and made it a success. And,
absolutely.
And hopefully there will be lots more.
Also,
like
bonus
it.
Points for Entertainment Weekly for putting putting Melissa McCarthy on the cover with a corgi.
Rock and roll.
Putting Melissa McCarthy on the cover, and then in the year end best thing, I think both Owen Gleiberman and Lisa Schwartzbaum put it in their like top three.
Yeah, it's getting a lot of good recognition for in top 10 lists at the end of the year, which is great. Which is great. Okay, so now that we have talked about our defining moments, we're going to cover a couple of other moments. And everybody's just going to pick a couple of things that happened this year that were important to you, that you thought were great, your best stuff of 2011, what thrilled you, what you thought was awesome. Stephen Thompson, give me a moment from 2011.
I do think it's worth acknowledging that at various points in the year, there was a sort of mass obsession with things that people viewed as, oh my God, this is the bottom of the barrel. We as a society have reached a point. And I'm, you know, speaking of Charlie Sheen and winning and all that, and of, you know, the Kardashian wedding.
Mm-hmm.
You used the phrase hand-wringing a bit when you were talking about Bridesmaids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we as a society, there was an enormous amount of, oh my God, this is just, we are just circling the toilet bowl. But I think it's important to remember it always rebounds from that.
Uh-huh.
The bar gets lowered and then it sort of gets reset.
Uh-huh.
And then it gets lowered again and then it gets reset. I think it's important to remember that like 20 years ago, there was a game show called Studs.
Uh-huh. Yes, there was.
Which was really just a bunch of revolting, disgusting nonsense.
That's funny.
And sort of funny. And
it was the end of the world.
I'm sorry. Is that the sound of Nero's fiddle I hear?
But I mean, that was very much what was said about Studs 20 years. This is just revolting, disgusting nonsense. This is the lowest we can possibly go. Yep. And then the bar just gets reset. And then there's Fear Factor. And then everybody's forgotten about Charlie Sheen and winning. Charlie Sheen is off there, you know, doing his thing. And who's talking about Charlie Sheen? Who's really talking? I mean,
well, you.
Me at the moment. But I think ultimately I want to leave this observation on an up note, which is just don't feel like this is the new low. Uh-huh. Because there'll always be a next new low, and it's not any lower than the low now.
There'll always be another low. You know, well chosen.
Yeah, you know, Julia Turner on the Slate Culture Gabfest made a point about the Kardashians, which I haven't heard other people make, which is that, of course, it's bad, but the people who are talking it down don't seem to understand how it's getting received. They assume that everybody who ingests the Kardashians is seeing it as sort of aspirational. And of course, the reason you watch these shows are to feel superior to it.
She's totally right.
So this idea that this is arrogance when you say, oh, it's the worst, and the people in the middle America
are just going to suck this up.
That's a very important point to make. And that people are watching it ironically. People are watching it and having fun with it. They feel just as you feel. Pretentious cultural critics.
Excellent point.
These are the dregs of society. Can't we all agree on that?
We can.
I think we can.
We can all hold hands and agree on that. All right. Trey Graham, moment of 2011.
All right. Three things, very quickly. There was a moment, I think it was back in June, I had been asked to write a first listen for NPR Music about a particular album, and I was sitting in a park, and I was listening to this album, and I got to a track called Hasadiga Ibo Y. And I thought I was going to die from joy and hilarity. It is the cast album of the Book of Mormon. And this music had been sort of closely held. The show was still in previews. We had actually done a story on the air for NPR, and they refused to give us the music, so we couldn't play it. So I was one of the first people to hear this music outside the theater. And when I realized just how solid and amazingly good this this show was, I was just awfully excited.
Great choice.
Two other moments much like that. Jan Maxwell in Follies.
Yes.
Sitting in the auditorium, watching her play that part. It was exciting all night long, but when she gets to the big scene and she sings Could I Leave You, that performance just took off into the stratosphere. And the hair stood up on my arms, and I knew right then that was a shortlist Tony nomination performance.
Mm-hmm.
Still running through January 2nd. Go see it, people. Seats are available. Third, Glenn Weldon recommended a book called The Great Night by a friend of his named Chris Adrian. We've talked about it several times, and I apologize, but there is a moment in the opening chapters where the big bad reveals himself to one of the protagonists, and it was another moment where I just gasped at how effective the writing was and how chilling the idea of this character presenting himself so immediately. It was one of those moments where a construct, a piece of fiction, a performance, just lifts you out of yourself and takes you somewhere else and consumes you completely, and it was thrilling. So
wonderful.
Yes, it was.
Great choices. Glenn Weldon, give me a moment from 2011.
I'm picking a scene from a show called Justified. This is a scene in the 9th episode of the 2nd season. It aired in April. The episode is called Brother's Keeper. It's a scene between Mags Bennett, played by Margot Martindale.
The great Margot Martindale.
And a rep from a mining company who is making an offer on her land. And this, I'm going to issue a minor spoiler about what happens in this episode. It's not a big thing. It's just a minor spoiler. The great thing about this scene is it's not a very emotional scene. I'm sure this is not something that went on her Emmy reel.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is a scene where what she has to project is a steely resolve.
Mm-hmm.
So the mine representative makes an offer on her land. She sends it back and says, I'll take 4 times that plus percentage of the profits from your mine. And the mine rep says, basically, your land is barren. There's no coal on it. And Mags Bennett, in a little tiny speech about how she wants to make it right for her family and for the future, for her kin, for the future, she realizes that what the mining company hasn't told her is that they don't need the land for the coal. They need the land to build a road to get to the mine so they can get their coal in and out.
Uh-huh.
And without this road, the mine is worthless to them. So what she has to project, again, is a steely resolve and an intelligence. And this dialogue could come so close to being over the top because she's explaining something about what's important to her, about her family and about kin. And it is done with such restraint and such power. I mean, there's all kinds of great stuff in that show, but that scene is where it really came alive for me.
Amazing. She's wonderful.
Show.
She is wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Okay. I am going to pick a moment from a movie that very, very few people saw in theaters called Meek's Cutoff, which many critics loved, not a lot of people saw.
Yep.
It is a Western about like a wagon train, and they are lost. And they are trying to find their way west, but they have fallen in with a questionable guide, and they're sort of losing confidence in him. In this film, it is, for large, large parts of this film, it is completely silent. It's almost like the Tree of Life, and that there are people who are sort of like, I don't get it. It doesn't even seem like a movie. And there is a moment fairly early in this film where three women are seen walking toward the camera. Mm. And the women in this movie obviously wear the sort of the long dress and the bonnet. And the bonnets are critical to the visuals in this movie. But in this scene, they're seen sort of at a distance, three of them, at varying distances from the camera. So it creates a sort of a triangle. And they're quite far away. So that their dresses are really just shapes. These women are really just seen as shapes mm-hmm. in the wind. And they're walking toward the camera, and the shapes are like just shifting, moving because of the way the wind is blowing. And when I sat in a theater at a screening of this movie and saw this, I realized that I was looking at it like a painting.
Right. Yeah.
And I was actually I was struck by it, and I realized that I had not the same feeling that I often have when I really see a really stirring scene in a movie, but what I think when I see a really amazing painting. Mm. And that's just a great moment when you feel your perspective sort of shift in that way, and you're seeing something you don't usually see. And I was so struck by it that I remember this so well, I literally put my hand to my heart, because you have that moment where you just go, oh. And I just, it was a great moment, and I always remember it. And it's available now on DVD and Blu-ray, and also it's on Netflix Instant at the moment. I fear that it will not work, but I do absolutely recommend that you see the film anyway. You will know the shot that I'm talking about when you see it. It's wonderful, and especially on a big screen, it was just stunning.
Do you recommend that I buy like an 80-inch plasma screen TV to view it?
Just to watch this movie.
I really do, and I feel that it's important to your cultural development as a person to buy the biggest television possible.
And then invite you over.
Yeah.
No,
I got you a little something.
It can be for just you. So that's that's mine.
Great pick.
Stephen Thompson, you got another moment?
To sort of pick up on your point about Meek's cutoff, for me, a moment, I was sitting there watching Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene and thinking, I have to watch the 10 Best Picture nominations, whatever they may be, and this is going to be among the more cheerful movies. Because there are a lot of massively critically acclaimed, massively grim-ass movies coming out.
Mm-hmm. There are some tough ones.
We need to talk about Kevin, Shame, Young Adult, The Tree of Life. Challenging movie.
May I recommend as an anodyne to some of that, the YouTube edit, We Need to Talk About Kitten, which consists of a series of shots of Tilda Swinton looking really, really anxious, and then cutaways to a kitten looking really, really fierce.
No, you may not.
I think you are well justified in recommending that. It makes me hugely hope, for, among other reasons, that Bridesmaids gets nominated for Best Picture. Mm. Just so that people who do these kind of Oscar death race, you're going to sit down and watch all 10 Best Picture nominations in a row, to sort of go, we should talk about Kevin and Shame, and all of a sudden it's like, wheedledee, it's Bridesmaids!
It's going to be a grim marathon.
It feels like it's one of those years, like the year that, like, No Country for Old Men was up against There Will Be Blood, right. And there was a lot of, like, the highest grossing of these movies made, like, $70 million. where people who were looking sort of for entry points into what the big movies of the year were kind of like, oh boy.
Right.
It really did make me wonder, like, what are the maybe fun movies that are going to get nominated?
Yeah. As I understand the way that the Oscar rules are working this year, there are going to be somewhere between 5 and 10 Best Picture nominees.
Oh, really?
It's not necessarily going to be 10. My understanding
Does this mean that Kung Fu Panda 2 is not going to get nominated?
It's not going to
be squeezed out.
You have a one bear mind. So there are a couple. The Artist is not a depressing movie. The Artist is a lovely, light cocktail of a movie.
Hugo.
That's one. Hugo is not a dark movie.
Right.
Hugo is a very beautiful, very loving homage to cinema, which The Artist is also. If there are 10 nominees, you could start to see things like Young Adult, which is essentially a black comedy. It really depends on how many things are nominated. You could see something like My Week with Marilyn, which, although it's sad, it's certainly not grim.
I just remember being so excited when Blue Valentine Valentine was not nominated last year, so I didn't have to watch.
It's really good, though. It's really good, though. But yeah, I think those are possibilities. The Descendants is sure to be nominated, pretty much. And The Descendants is, you know, not an incredibly dark, depressing movie. It definitely has its dark moments, but it's not. No, but it is absolutely true. You're going to see, if you go to the whole marathon, you're going to probably see some We Need to Talk About Kevin and some Shame. And those are both pretty devastating and hopeless movies. So
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah,
enjoy Happy that. New Year, everybody.
Enjoy that. Happy New Year. Trey Graham, moment of 2011.
I'm going to try to squeeze two in again. The scene in Contagion where they peel off Gwyneth Paltrow's scalp. We have discussed Linda's reluctance to hear about anything in Contagion, or anything really about Contagion.
They all die.
Everybody dies is basically what happens in Contagion. That movie really captured a lot of my obsessions surrounding epidemics and and the end of the world.
No. We've discussed, yes.
The moment where, spoiler, Gwyneth Paltrow has died from this plague and is taken into the autopsy room, and they literally peel her scalp off look at her brain.
All right,
moment of horror filmmaking. And similarly, there's a moment in one of the early episodes of American Horror Story where it became very, very clear, not that the show was going to set a new standard for creepiness, or it was going to be weird, or it was going to be particularly stylish, all of which it is, but there was a moment where it became very, very clear that Jessica Lange was going to mop the floor with anyone who was in a scene with her, unless possibly it was Frances Conroy, and I have been enjoying the hell out of that series, not least because of the size and the just strangeness of those performances.
Agreed. Very good. Glenn Weldon, moment of 2011.
Lightning round, because I've talked about some of these before, so I'll just touch on them. I maintain that Chris Evans' performance in Captain America is great. I think people get distracted by the cartoonish physicality, because he either looks like a stick insect or a mountain of flesh, and it's very hard to see the performance. But I say go back to a scene right as he's driving up, being driven up to the medical experiment to see the work that he does in that scene. It's really subtle and it's really good.
I'm with
you. Andrew Garfield's heartfelt speech at Comic-Con about what Spider-Man means to him.
Yes.
He was speaking my language there.
Yes.
The page in Ultimate Spider-Man where I turn the page and I see Spidey take off his mask, the new Spider-Man, take off his mask to reveal he's a black Puerto Rican kid who looks an awful lot like Donald Glover.
You bet.
I think that's an important scene. Every page of a comic called to BB, which I've talked about and I've reviewed, it's just fantastic. The scene in Aquaman number one, the reboot of Aquaman, where the King of the Seven Seas patiently explains to a reporter that, of course, he doesn't talk to fish because they don't have brains that can process language. I read that, and for 6 seconds, I felt it was a shout-out to me because I had written a piece that took that premise from McSweeney's back in 2006. That was a pretty good 6 seconds, let me just say, where I felt like it was like coming out of me, and then I realized what a coincidence is. Every single Stefan segment on SNL starring Bill Hader.
Oh, I gotcha.
Particularly the one where he references the lazily named drag queen named Melvin in a dress. That is a perfect joke. That is a perfect joke.
Yeah, it really is.
A cutaway in Parks and Recreation. We've talked about Parks and Recreation a lot on the show, so I don't want to give away what this is. We'll link to it on the show page. But the funniest joke about Native American war atrocities that has ever been put.
That's true.
A surprisingly dark joke for such a sunny show, but that's the reason it works. Mm-hmm. And finally, a scene in Bob's Burgers where Bob has taken two jobs to pay for his daughter's birthday party. This is a classic premise. It's a sitcom premise. It could have been in The Honeymooners. What wouldn't happen in The Honeymooners is that Bob comes back to his wife first thing in the morning after he's been out all night. He says, I may or may not have tried crack last night. I don't think I did, but if I did, I liked it. That would not have happened on The Honeymooners.
All right. I will mention before I move to my actual one that my Parks and Recreation moment is a shot of Amy Poehler that takes place during April and Andy's wedding episode. And if you go see it, you can see, in my opinion, she earns 100 Emmys in one little brief moment while they are getting married. And it's hard to explain beyond that, but that is my Parks and Rec moment. What I'm really going to say, and you'll think I'm kidding when I say it at first, but I assure you that I'm not, is Royal Wedding. Huh. As many of you know, I was in London for the Royal Wedding this spring, and as much as I would like to say that it was ridiculous and cornball, and it was, and it was mobbed, and it was silly, there's something to be said for the English affection for pomp. that I really came to sort of like while I was there. And I remember a woman that I talked to who was sort of, she couldn't really explain her own affection for it except to sort of talk about the horses and the majesty. And she knows that it's kind of irrational. But she was talking about watching the horses and the parade and everything. And she said, it's so English. It really is fun to sort of immerse yourself briefly in something that you really do not experience a whole lot of. Americans do not have the same great affection for pomp that is not nationalistic specifically.
I'm gonna differ with you here. I'm gonna say that you don't know enough Anglicans.
Well, sure. But what I'm saying is, for me, that experience being with all those people, crushed with all those people out on the street in the morning, watching, you know, getting all excited, waiting for everything to happen, watching the cars come by, watching the open carriage come by the other way, it was actually really, really fun, and I'm really glad I did it. And it was a giant moment for me in 2011, and yeah. I would always, always mention it.
Good fun.
So those are our moments of 2011. You should feel free to come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or at the blog at Monkey C and share your moments from 2011. And now we are going to do a quick round, as is our wont, of what is making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
A few quick things. Our beloved friend and colleague, Barry Hardiman, is on a Barry special episode of... All Songs Considered.
Nice.
Those of you who listen to this podcast and love Barry but don't necessarily listen to All Songs should seek it out. She's once again talking about holiday music and is delightful.
We love Barry.
I received a book from my dear pal Linda Holmes called Wreck the Halls, which is a spinoff from the website Cake Wrecks, which is professionally made cakes gone horribly and hilariously awry. Sat down on my couch and read it to/with my kids, and there were points at which our laughter was sort of triggering this loop of laughter that involved tears and was wonderful. The fact that I intend to spend Christmas catching up on the Parks and Recreation DVDs that I bought on Black Friday.
Nice.
And we'll sit there with a big, big bucket of popcorn and a big pile of blankets and spend Christmas watching Leslie Knope. And finally, that the Wisconsin Badgers are in the Rose Bowl on Wisconsin.
Excellent. On Wisconsin. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
I was circling several things for this. In addition to the fact that I'm leaving tomorrow to go spend Christmas with my nephews. Hi, boys. I came across a YouTube clip, which is absolutely the thing that is making me happy today. It is Jessica Lange's interview with Craig Ferguson back around the time they launched American Horror Story. It is loopy, is what it is.
It would be.
She is either having a great deal of fun, or possibly sleep-deprived, or possibly high as a kite. Mm-hmm. But it is the
no
most...
No offense, Jessica Lange.
Right, no offense, Jessica Lange. More power to you.
We mean high on life.
More, right. It was too funny. Like, he wasn't sure where she was going, couldn't keep her on track. Mm-hmm. I think she was toying with him sometimes, and he eventually asked her about her tattoos and talked about her breasts. And it was kind of extraordinary. But I went down the rabbit hole and watched a whole bunch of Jessica Lange on YouTube, and I love that lady. I love that. She's a fantastic actress and really smart, which is what made that performance on Craig Ferguson so different.
Trey is really fixated on Jessica.
I really
Lange
am. I'm kind
week.
Of in love. I'm in love. I'm
I
in
don't
love.
Know. You're branching out there, Trey. Yeah.
I would just like to propose, actually, that Jessica Lange is well within the defined universe of acceptable things
true.
For gay men to be obsessed
That's
about.
True.
I understand.
Good point, Trey. A British film called The Trip, starring Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon. It actually was originally a 6-episode series on British television. It was condensed into a film. It was directed by Michael Winterbottom.
Winterbottom.
I was just going to say.
Please. Okay. So these two actors.
You people.
They played versions of themselves. Steve Coogan's version is a little bit more of a jerk, and Rob Brydon's is probably a little bit more sunnier and guileless than he actually is. The premise is Steve Coogan gets invited to tour the north of England and review very fancy restaurants. He wants to take his girlfriend. She backs out. He goes through 5 or 6 of his friends. They all back out, and he finally has to choose Rob Brydon, who he kind of knows. He maybe did a film with him, but they're not really great friends. And so they drive in a truck through the north of England, and they stop at these inns. And this film is about the way that these two actors who don't particularly like each other and are constantly making fun of each other come to a kind of friendship. But this film is so British, so dry, so subtle, so acerbic that that movement is maybe happens in a nanosecond. You see when they are riffing on each other, and most famously the scene where they riff on each other is when they're just sitting around on the table waiting for their dinner and they start imitating Michael Caine, or they start imitating Sean Connery, and it goes back and forth, and there is such joy in this riffing. You can see it in their eyes that their relationship is really in these moments. These moments, if this was an American film, you know, it would end with hugs and tears and puppies, and it would be ridiculous. But because these are two British dudes, that doesn't happen. The film has almost a sullen tone to it. It's very weird, but the insults that go back and forth and that joy you find in riffing with a friend and going back and forth, you start to think that you can see the actual relationship these two actors have beneath the film, kind of coming to the surface. I have laughed louder and harder at this film than I have in any film in recent memory. The Trip. It's a great film.
Excellent. Great choice. I will look for it.
You should.
I promise to look for it. What is making me happy this week will come as a surprise to no one. Jimmy Fallon hosted Saturday Night Live this week, and it was pretty widely regarded to be a very fine episode of Saturday Night Live. There were a tremendous number of people who showed up on this.
Yeah, it was like half the celebrity universe.
Not only sort of, you know, people out of nowhere like Jude Law on Weekend Update kind of for no reason, but also, you know, a bunch of people who have been on the show before. Tracy Morgan showed up. Horatio Sanz showed up. Amy Poehler and Tina Fey showed up with Jimmy Fallon for a joke-off on Weekend Update between the old team of Tina Fey and Jimmy Fallon and the after-that team of Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler. So they had a little joke-off. My personal favorite, just because it was so strange and should not have worked at all and lasted for 6 minutes and really I still thought was funny, was Jimmy Fallon playing Beethoven, introducing the band, his band, which was like, and it shouldn't have worked at all. It's so weird, and it's such a dumb idea, and it's just him, like, riffing, like, let me introduce the band, and then it'll be, like, the guy who plays the flute, and then the guy who plays the tuba. The faces were all funny, and every time he would introduce somebody, you would know that you were just going to get some little tiny bit of weirdness, and they all sort of worked in their own different ways, and it was one of those bizarre ideas where, for once, the fact that they just throw an idea out and just kind of keep doing it over and over again, which is usually how that show is terrible, actually worked very well for them. So what makes me happy is when I turn out to be right about things. And I have been on the Jimmy Fallon train for quite a long time.
Yes, indeed.
And so what is making me happy this week is a good outing for my imaginary friend. I like to think of us as pals. He doesn't know who I am. So that's what's making me happy. And as always, you know, you guys should all feel free to come and tell us what's making you happy, because we do care deeply what's making you happy. This is our last show of 2011. Well, we will be back in 2012. We are taking next week off.
I do think it's a fine time to say that among the things making us happy this year is our fantastic and wonderful listeners, our Facebook community,
of
people we've really gotten to know. And,
absolutely.
And so if you are not liking us on Facebook, you can give us a holiday gift by liking us on Facebook.
You should.
And you're going to be home for the holidays, so, you know, log into your parents' Facebook page and have them like us too.
Absolutely. Introduce our podcast to your friends. And of course, I think all of us would say at the end of this year, our esteemed producer Mike Katzeff, who we love for providing us with in and out music, for providing us with editing, for slow clapping almost every week at something.
Almost, yeah.
There would be no Pop Culture Happy Hour without Mike Katzeff.
There would not. So
we also sound a lot dumber with our ums and our ahs.
It's true.
It's true.
So I think the end of the year is always a good time to appreciate folks. So we would also give our appreciation to Mike, and of course to all of you guys.
Shucks.
I actually like all of you.
I know.
People.
And heading into the new year, as always, you can find all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You do not actually have to dislike Stephen for that to work. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. Trey with an E, Graham like the graham cracker crust in your Christmas pie. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. And speaking of our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, you can follow Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. And perhaps you can get him to tweet about his band, Hello Come In, which provides our in-and-out music, of which we were just speaking, which makes us happy all year round. So thanks to all of you guys for being here this week and throughout 2011.
You bet.
And thanks to all of you for listening this week and throughout 2011. And we will see you in 2012.